Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 11 of Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan's Courage to Thrive show, where every month he helps us find joy and hope in no matter what we're doing. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, founder of Incandescent PR and the proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent.tv. And you'll also find us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts. You are going to love this month's guests. Kirby Peters of Maple Bank Farm in Roxbury, Connecticut, is going to focus on our topic, salt of the earth. We dive deep into the art of running a farm. Quickly, before I throw it over to Bob, Maple Bank Farm has been operating since 1730 and has provided quality, fresh products while providing a destination that exemplifies what a farm stand can mean to a small town. He's the current caretaker and manager who runs the farm and the stand's day-to-day operations. So we can't wait to hear all about this. Over to you, Bob.
Thanks, Hope. Thanks, as always. Appreciate the introduction. Kirby, welcome to Courage to Thrive. I'm so happy to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So why don't we start? Hope has given us a little background, but why don't you start off and say, in your words, tell me about your farm.
Definitely. Yeah. So I think kind of the big message about the farm that a lot of people like to talk about is the history of our farm. Mm-hmm. For the longest time, we've been one of the longest family run farms in the country, dating back to the 1730s. What's kind of funny about that is I'm the first person to run the farm. That's not part of the original Hurlbut family. Wow. And so Kathy and her husband, Howie, still own the farm. And right, she's the eighth generation that's been on this land, which is pretty incredible.
So
there's a lot of history to the farm. But in general, the farm is about 70 acres. Mm-hmm. And we produce mixed vegetables and fruit, primarily for retail. And we sell pretty much everything through our farm stand here in Roxbury.
Oh, cool. So let me just, because it's an interesting bit of land, I think... If I understand things correctly, you have a large tract of land, well, large for Connecticut, right? A tract of land across the Chappaugh River, if I got my rivers right. And then you have another tract of land where the farm stand is as well. So I wonder what it's like. And the area around the farm stand, which you have some fruit trees and you also have blueberries and some of your houses, greenhouses, is not flat land. Why don't you talk about the land and talk about what that, you know, what the acreage looks like.
Definitely. Yeah. So yeah, there are a few pieces of land that we manage. So the main piece of land, which I call like the home farm, which is where the stand is, that's about 50 acres. Mm. And that is kind of the original plot of land. And so that's where our apple orchard is, the blueberries are. And so the farm has had many iterations of what it's looked like over the years. Mm-hmm. If you ever want to visit our website, it kind of goes over the whole timeline, because it's just has so much history. There's been a lot of different things have happened with the farm. So when Kathy and Howie took over from their parents, before that, it was mainly chickens and egg production. There were some apple trees and some other fruits. But when Kathy and Howie took it over, they primarily wanted to switch over to doing vegetables. And they really wanted to, you know, have the farm stand be more of a key part of their sales. It was kind of hard to grow on this piece of land. It's quite hilly. The farm stand's right in the middle of a valley. Mm-hmm. The soil's pretty heavy. So they were growing up here. It's not like they couldn't grow, but they were able to come across this opportunity to buy a piece of land, I think in 1995, that was the year I was born, down in the valley right next to the Chappaugh River off of 67. And that's like premier cropland. Mm-hmm. The silty loam soil, it's right next to that river. It is in a floodplain, which is not great, but it makes for incredible soil. It drains really well. And so they bought that. And I think Kathy and Howie would probably say this, is that that was really transformative for the operation, was to come across that land, because it was just such good soil for growing. and just created a really good environment for right, producing really nice products. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit funny because we have to drive over there every day. It's like a 7-10 minute trip. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of growers would say that's worth being able to produce in soil that's just really suited for producing good crops.
Mm-hmm. It's cool and it's beautiful land. I mean, both yep. Places are lovely, beautiful Connecticut lands. So that's really great. And so, you know, you're I could say it, you're in your early 30s now, but in looking at a bit of your resume, you know, you've wanted to be a farmer and work toward being a farmer for a long time. So how did you become a farmer? What was that like for you?
Yeah, honestly, I think my journey is a very different. I think being a farmer is a really unique identity, especially mm-hmm. in the fact that a lot of farmers just inherit not necessarily the land, but they inherit yeah. the identity of being a farmer. Mm-hmm. I did not come from a farming family. My father's a minister and my mom was a pastry chef. And so it was just like not necessarily something that I was exposed to from an early age. And being a farmer was not actually what I always thought my path would be. And so, yeah, I always had a kind of passion, I would say a passion for growing mm-hmm. and for, yeah, just like producing something, working with nature. And I kind of just followed that passion and interest because it's what I wanted to do. To be honest, I never thought I'd be a farmer. For many reasons, I thought financially it wouldn't work. Me as, you know, a queer young person, I just didn't see that as something that was available to me. Mm-hmm. And so, right, I thought I would just, you know, work somewhere in the field, whether it was in research or in some of their production sphere, whether it was, you know, indoor hydroponics or something that was more like modern, like, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. obviously it's like someone who's not traditionally, like a traditional farmer, it just didn't seem like it would fit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was that turn? 'Cause you know, you look like you were doing a lot of people in around your generation studying environmental science. And then was the turn kind of in college? Because then you switched over to the ag, you know, it looks like the ag program at Cornell. So was that what made a change for you, or was it just kind of happenstance?
Yeah, I think kind of going along what I was saying is, so I went into college studying biology. I switched mm-hmm. to environmental science. There really is a path here. I started with biology. I went to environmental science because mm-hmm. I really was passionate about environmental issues. Was way more on the science track mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even within those disciplines, I was just focusing more on agriculture because mm-hmm. it was just what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at a certain point, and, you know, it only takes like a small bug in your ear. I had a neighbor growing up. She was maybe on the board of Cornell Med. I can't remember, but she had some relation to Cornell. And she was like, you know, you should look at Cornell. And I was always just mm-hmm. like, I'm not getting into Cornell. Like, it does not happen. Like, that's so silly.
Yeah.
But, you know, when those moments when you're like, I wonder if this could be a possibility, or like, you know, I really want to study ag. I was like, oh, that, you know, she did mention to me with the ag program, I should really check that out. And so I did, and I paid it some more attention. And so, yeah, I mean, I was applying to other institutions too. Cornell was the first choice and the first one I applied mm-hmm. to. And I got in, so I was like, I'm not going anywhere else. I kind of just, again, the journey just kind of carried me forward. And I just listened to what I am interested in. And I feel really grateful for that because mm-hmm. I feel like people don't always necessarily have like a clear, especially when it comes to a career, a clear idea of what they mm-hmm. really want to be doing and how it aligns with what they like doing. And I feel very fortunate that it has just worked out that way mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who, you know, kind of kind of say, well, I'm gonna do this, but then hit some obstacles and along the way, and you know, wind up doing something completely different than their passion or their passion's such a rough word these days, you know, but your interests and to be able to go into that in that area and follow that through. I mean, I kind of look at my career as, you know, there's part of me that lives life 5-10 minutes at a time. You know, I think most of my life is just kind of what's in front of me, and I'm doing what's presented to me. And then there's a small part that says, okay, this is the overall arch of my career or my vocation and my work. And yeah, it makes sense. You know, it doesn't necessarily, the bigger picture doesn't necessarily make sense in the moment, but kind of the overall thing, like, oh yeah, it is tending toward these themes. So cool. So you spent some time in Texas, and then, but you grew up in this area. And so I wonder, you know, when the opportunity for this farm opened up for you to manage it, you know, is there, you know, kind of a vision of growing up in this area in Connecticut that shaped your understanding of farming, or was that not even an aspect? I mean, you know, because you could have farmed not near home, and probably, you know, kind of found, you know, there's a lot better land than in Connecticut for farming at times.
Yes and no. I mean, like, yeah. There's really good quality growing conditions in Connecticut. Mm. The economics of growing in Connecticut are really tough, mainly when it comes to land access. Yeah. Just because it's like, especially in Roxbury, well, this area, this like Roxbury, Bridgewater, well, Litchfield County in general, it's just crazy. For a young person, it's just like unfathomable, like how you can, you know, access land, because it's just so expensive. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there's more things we can talk about that too. There's ways to, you know, kind of combat that. But to talk about your question in terms of, you know, coming back here and running this farm. I don't know if I really would be running a farm if it wasn't for Maple Bank. It kind of is really like an ideal situation for someone like me. I walked into like a turnkey operation. Kathy and Howie have had like, they really established an amazing business. The customer base is super supportive. And there was a lot of excitement with me coming back because there really are not a lot of young people that come back here. There was a lot of excitement. People are really just happy to be coming to the stand, meet customers, and, you know, buying food that we're producing. I don't know. I don't think I would necessarily be a farmer. I really don't think I would be a farmer if this opportunity hadn't really arisen. Yeah. And to speak to a little bit more about like how I got here. I was in Austin for 5 years, and I love my time in Austin. I really needed it. Like, yeah. I was not someone who wanted to stay in Roxbury at all.
Sure.
I needed to get out and experience what else there was, because Roxbury, for people who don't know, was a town of 2,000 people. And my father was a minister. So it was just like, I knew a lot of people. A lot of people knew me. And again, being a queer person, like, I was like, I need to get out to the cities.
Yeah.
And so I got to have that life, which was great. And I am just so grateful for that. But at a certain point, I felt like I was at a crossroads for like what I was doing. I was working at a hydroponics company, a startup, and I was ready for something else. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like sometimes I can't tell if I'm lucky or if life just presents itself and I like take the opportunity. But this is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. I came back here for the first time after the pandemic to visit my family. And I met with Kathy and Howie because I, you know, they're like mentors to me. I worked for them in high school, and they taught me a lot. And we just got talking about the farm and how they were not sure, you know, if it was going to be operating in the next year. They just weren't sure what they were going to do. And that's just how the conversation got going in terms of me running the farm and wondering if that was an option. And that was not something I had planned at all, like at all. But it had presented itself. And I love this farm. It really has taught me so much of what I know. And in hindsight, I feel like it makes a lot of sense for me to be here.
Cool. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about the challenges that you see in farming, you know, for a young person as yourself, and just, you know, some of the things that you've faced that you mentioned before. Why don't we dive into that for a little bit and give you some chance to talk about it?
Yeah, in terms of the difficulties of being here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, I know everyone talks about affordability right now. Everyone's kind of struggling with that. Here it's like inaccessible. It's not even unaffordable. It's just like you can't buy anything here. I think the average home price is over $1 million in Roxbury. And it's just also a relatively rural area. And so there's not much in terms of things to do. I mean, sure, there's hiking and whatnot, which is all, these are all great things. But there's also the community aspect, you know, there's not a lot of young people. So young people aren't necessarily going to move here.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, it's definitely a little weird. I mean, I work a lot, so it's not always as apparent because I'm so busy, but it's a little isolating at times. Just because everyone knows me, which is like really nice. I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people know me.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have access to me, you know, when I'm at the stand and whatnot. And it's great to see people that have known me since I was a child. But not a lot of people I'm in community with, you know, it's not, you know, these young people that were, you know, we're going out for dinner, we're going out for drinks once a week or, you know, once a month or whatever, or, you know, these community organized events, you know? And so that's kind of tough for sure. And I think that's kind of the thing that a lot of young, especially queer people in rural communities face is trying to find the community and how that fits right for them.
I mean, you're touching on something I think about a lot of how do these communities, you know, where the real estate is so expensive and the entry level to it for any kind of homeowner is really pretty high right now. And it's someone's looking at it. I mean, if one's a teacher or you know, has a skill that is, you know, can be employed locally, sure. But, you know, if you want to, you know, be somebody in a tech business, that's just that's just not predominantly available here as it is in the major cities. Equally banking or other kind of large industry options, they're of, and certainly high skill, other than kind of nursing, nursing and doctors and teachers, which are all kind of service for the people who live here. Beyond that, it's a challenge. We don't have like a lot of rural communities, we don't have either a small manufacturing base that's going to employ a variety of different people that would attract young people or a variety of people to be a part of these small communities. I think it's something that's probably true across America, you know, that given, you know, there isn't a lot of small manufacturing, there isn't a lot of small kind of business in these towns other than kind of servicing the people around. It's a challenge. So I think you've certainly hit and described what that challenge is really well.
I think too, what's kind of unique about Connecticut, I mean, I think Connecticut's not really a topic of conversation for most people, but depending on where you are in the state, you really are pulled in a certain direction. So like we're on the west side of the state, and so we have a heavy New York City influence. And I think probably the east side of the state probably has a pretty heavy Boston influence in terms of industry, people who are living in Connecticut but are commuting into these cities. And so that's just kind of like a unique kind of part of Connecticut that I think maybe some people don't really realize if they're living in other parts of the country.
I mean, the Connecticut River, one side of the Connecticut River is, you know, Boston Red Sox fans, and the other side of it is Yankee fans, because principally because that's the breakdown of the television stations, you know, for most part. So it's that kind of influence, but it is that kind of challenge. I mean, there is, you know, and from here and in this part of the state, you know, one's got at least an hour drive in heavy commute to get to a major city, call it Hartford or Greenwich or White Plains or Stamford or Norwalk. It's you know, it's a hike. And so that's part of the challenge too. Without having, you know, major transportation alternatives, no busing, no trains, commuter trains, or that kind of thing. So yeah. All right. So let's go back. Let's back to farming for a minute. You know, what is it? You know, what is the farming process itself is, you know, varied. What's your favorite thing about farming? What do you like best, if there is something? You
know? Yeah. No, it's a really good question. I mean, farming, there's a lot to farming. So, but yeah, I think to me, it's just like the end goal is obviously to produce a product.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I love most is kind of like at the end when you can harvest that, like for me, it's like a pumpkin. I'm like, God. And it's like a high quality pumpkin. You know, you put all this work into it, because the reality is in farming, there's so many variables and things like that can just go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And variables that are out of your control. You know, it's not a controlled climate. The weather is kind of unpredictable. You don't know if you're going to be short on labor one day. You know, there's just a lot of things that can go wrong. So, you know, when you can get to a place where you're harvesting something, you're like, wow, we did a really good job on this, and the product looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really, really good feeling, especially when, like, you know, it's nice for us. So we have a retail environment right on the farm. So, you know, we know it looks good. And when customers can come in here and also appreciate it, you know, it's that kind of full circle thing, you know, where you got to see both ends of the cycle, which is really quite nice.
That's cool. I mean, I just do, you know, small hobby stuff. I don't grow tomatoes because you can do it for far better, far cheaper than me, you know, like most people. So I avoid tomatoes where I can. But, you know, I would say for me, often, you know, and my experience would be at the other end of the scale, seeing things break the ground and seeing that beginning process, seeing the result. You know, it can be, as you say, it's so dependent on forces that are unseen, you know, I mean, and yes, most sprouts don't, you know, that don't make it to full fruition, or a lot of them maybe not even come out of the ground. So, but it's that potential, I guess, I get excited about. So, but also, you know, it's nice to be on the other end to say, here's what all that work and patience and care produces. I can appreciate that too. So,
I don't think you're alone, like, especially in the spring. We sell a lot of potted plants in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really easy to see all the enthusiasm and the excitement. Mm-hmm. I always wonder, like, how many of these plants are just dying when people bring them home. But for sure, I mean, people get so excited about planting in the spring and getting ready for things to produce. I just think for me, like, the process of growing is what I've always loved. Mm-hmm. And I think too, like, as I've like had more experience, I know what it takes more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does take a lot of specific things and really precise timing a lot of the time. And so when you know you did all that work, and even amongst all the odds that, like, you know, that the weather brings and whatnot, it's still still produced an amazing crop. It's really quite nice.
Yeah. Talk about, you do have animal husbandry, so you have some sheep. And so are they, I know Howie I even think that he would even shear the sheep, if I recall seeing that, or he had somebody come in. But what do the sheep provide for you? How does that supplement or influence your farming? And
yeah Yeah, so Kathy and Howie, they still manage a few things on the farm. So the sheep are still under their management,
Okay.
and so are the apples.
Okay.
So that's really more of their realm, but I can still speak to kind of what they provide for us. They, in terms of economic value, they're not like a huge driving force on our farm. I wouldn't say sheep in general are like a huge economic producer for most people here in the US. But they really are part of the character of the farm for us. It's pretty hard to envision the farm without the sheep. And I think you asked customers like their memories of Maple Bank Farm, it would be the sheep. And so, yes, in terms of economics, I think they probably aren't doing a whole lot in terms of, bringing us some more income. But they do create a huge motivator or motivation for people to come, or demand for people to come because
Yeah, I mean,
they
it's a lot
want
of joy
to.
seeing those sheep kind of roll and tumble down the hill
For
and
sure.
leading away, and
Yes.
so that's fun, you know, it's fun for the
Yes.
kids and that kind of stuff. So I can see, yeah, that is a joy there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, when I've always described Maple Bank as like the charm that comes along with the stand, because it's just you kind of drive in and it's just like you get this feeling, and then part of that is like our staff can call the sheep down the hill, and to see them come down, just like that landscape, you can see the landscape and the sheep coming down the hill is just I think it's something that you would want to be able to capture. And you can't really always do it without just being there. So it's a pretty special thing, I think.
Yeah, cool. So your dad's a minister. You know, I know it's as I, yeah, I've been one for 20, almost 25 years, coming up pretty soon. And so I know that this question, you know, and having a couple children a little bit older than you, but having that you know, this you're going to have your own answer to this question. So, you know, your father might have a different answer, and but I do think it's interesting to me, and so I'll ask it. So, and it doesn't have to be interesting to you, but I wonder how, if at all, you know, faith shapes your work, or spirit, you know, do you have a, is there a spiritual connection in farming that you feel may, and it may not, but I wonder about that.
Yeah, for sure. My father's been a minister for, I don't know, 40 years or so. I've never really had a connection to faith. I was one of those kids, and I feel awful for my parents, honestly, because like I was in church and I just did not want to be there since I got in. Like I just never wanted to be there. I kind of always had an aversion to it. Not that I don't like church, it's just like it's just not my thing. I've thought about this question. About kind of the connection with what I do and in terms of spirituality, I'm not really a spiritual person, and I am so like in the weeds, you could say, in the science of what I do. It's sometimes hard to think about that spiritual component. Not to say that science and spirit like spirituality are at odds. That's not what I want to say, but for me, I just don't pair the two. I'm just so much more focused on like the science of soil and the microbiology in soil. And I think for a lot of people, they could see that as they could have a spiritual connection to that in terms of,
Yeah, how about
things going on.
let's kind of stay on that for a second, because I think it's, you know, it's familiar territory for me, because I think my children, or certainly one of my children, would answer the same way. You know, and I think, you know, if they grew up as, you know, they were in their, you know, five, six, seven when I was attending seminary. So it's they have that experience as well. So you grew up completely within in it. But I think there's a challenge that children face, particularly when it's, you know, the leader, a spiritual leader of a small town, you know, everybody knows you, and there's a spotlight on you that you didn't ask for. And there's a kind of unspoken demands that go with it, even to my question. You know, I mean, you know, if your dad was a banker, well, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't make a connection to say, gee, you know, what's your connection with banking to farming? You know, it wouldn't be there. You know, there's so it's a bit, even there, it's a bit unfair, right? And yet, people have an expectation of that, and there's a lot of, you know, kind of social pressure around this that can be there as a pastor's kid, you know.
Yeah. So I had a sister, or I have a sister, and
she appreciates you saying that.
Yeah. I know. she actually lives here. She lives in Roxbury now too, which is kind of nice. She was in California for a long time, and so for both of us to be back, it's kind of fun. But yeah, I think if you asked the two of us, we definitely had different experiences when it came to being a minister's child. She was 6 years older than I, and so she really got exposed to it, I think, before I did. And I think she had a harder time with it than I did. I think there's a reason why there's kind of the trope of the minister's daughter. Because yeah, it's just that it's like a weird, so it is a weird like type of pressure to experience at a young age. Mm-hmm. And for me, I've always, you know, yes, my dad's a minister. I see him more as a community leader, especially mm-hmm. in Roxbury. And so it's not just the religious aspect, because for me, my dad never put like any weird pressure on us religiously, like mm-hmm. ever. And I like love him for that. Like that was just like the best thing, because so many people have a different experience yeah. when it comes to when they have parents that are, you know, in the church.
Yeah. So your sister had a different. Yeah. No, your sister
yeah.
had that experience. And I think you're kind of leaning into the social pressure or the attention that comes with it. That's unfair. I don't know if it's unfair, but it is unfair.
Yeah. I think what I was trying to say is like, there's the religious aspect and there's the community aspect.
Yeah.
And for me, it was much more the community aspect, which I have really shaped me in many ways. Like mm-hmm. I'm definitely a person who wants to be around and involved in community. I want to be able to see people that I know daily. But at a young age, it's tough. Like when so many people know you, like, I don't know these people, you know, like, I'm young and like everyone's like, oh, I know your father. And I'm like, okay. Like,
yeah.
And yeah, there's just a lot of people that know you. And especially for me, you know, growing up gay, I was like, I am not coming out. Yeah, I am not sure. coming out here. Like there are way too many people who know me. Like I need to get out of my environment. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think there's kind of two ends to it. I think there's some weird pressure, but at the same time, honestly, being older, I really appreciate kind of that community involvement.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be fair to say that my children are, you know, kind of appreciate some of the skills that they get, that you have gotten, and some of the, you know, some of their ways of being able to navigate the world because of the things that they had to learn very quickly, you know, that, you know, being center of attention, being somebody who's known, but not known, you know, people know who you are, but don't know you, you yeah. know, and that kind of thing. And it's good and bad, and it's a challenge. But that's interesting. So it's a very unique kind of life. I mean, it's a difference. It's, you know, different than say having a famous parent as an actor which of course there are some in this area, you know, kids of actors and that exposure is a little bit different than being kind of the local community leader, the local, you know, person that people lean on, and then, you know, having the family structure around that to kind of go, well, what is it like for that family to have this person? There's a little, it's a dynamic that I'm still trying to understand myself, you know, and I don't have to worry about it as much because I, most of my life now is working with seminaries and writing, and so it's not that day-to-day attention, but I remember it really well, and that curiosity factor and the expectations people have on the rest of the family. So that's thank you for letting me dive into that a little bit. So I mean, I think this question kind of leads out of that, is that what do you see as, and in a way you responded to the owners of the farm in the sense of community and the vitalness of this farm as an institution in the town. And I wonder, how do you see, and I think you see Maple Bank as a part of the community and also as a bit of an institution, an important factor in the community. And so what do you see, let me ask it this way, why do you see, small local farms, vital or maybe not to a community?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to that question. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what's apparent right now is, we're hearing a lot about the cyclospora outbreak, which is that, the extreme diarrhea that everyone's hearing about in the news, and which has been great for us. there have been every farm is talking about being up.
Yeah,
20 to 30% this year, which is just amazing. It's amazing for us. Yeah. We're so busy, which is good and also really training. But it provides a really good example of why, it's really nice to have these small, more local farms available amongst these huge consolidated operations, because you get, for example, you get some type of parasite that is in an operation, and then now it's spread to a whole bunch of lettuce that's spread throughout the whole entire country. Mm-hmm. Whereas, we're relatively isolated here. We're producing for, a town of 2,000. But, the amount of customers that are coming in day by day is somewhere in the 200s, and the nice thing about Connecticut too is there's a lot of training around food safety, which is incredible. But yeah, I think it shows a really good example of why, in terms of, diversity is always a good thing, but why we should make sure that we're still making sure that not everything's so consolidated, and that we still have some of these smaller operations that can produce for the local community. But I mean, that too, say something happened and they're that farm had to shut down, and they all of a sudden couldn't send anything out. And it's there still needs to be something that can keep up with that demand. Mm-hmm. So what I like to say is we're always here. Whether people want to come to us or not, we're always here and we're available. And I really have been trying to encourage people, because we've seen a lot of new faces at the farm because of this, is even when the explosive diarrhea is gone, we are still here. You can still come to us. But yeah, I think that's a small subset of what we're talking about. But I mean, farms in general, our farm, the big thing, especially for Kathy and Howie, has been farmland preservation. Mm-hmm. So our farm has been preserved. The development rights have been sold to the state, so no one can develop the land. This is really, really big for Kathy and Howie. It's one of their big priorities, and their family, to make sure that this farm stays a farm that is farming into the future. And that's not only important in general, but for Roxbury, like you say, it's almost like an institution. And that's because it's a small town. There's not much here. We have some businesses, but I mean, there's really not a lot. And so it's something that we really want to make sure stays. And once farmland is gone, it's been developed, you can't get it back. So there's a really big push, I think, everywhere, but especially in Connecticut. There's some pretty strong programs for farmland preservation to make sure that we're not just giving up this land and never able to get it back. Mm-hmm. But that too, it kind of goes into the small business thing as well. Small businesses are so important, in my opinion, especially nowadays. When we talk about consolidation, I also think about consolidation of wealth. And the money you spend locally most likely stays locally. I'm shopping at local businesses with the money that I'm getting from my business, you know, like, and that creates a really healthy local economy. And to me, that's something we can sustain, unlike a model of trillionaires. And so, right, I just think in general, local businesses are something that we should really be trying to focus more on. And local farms fit right into that.
Cool. That's great. So you went to Cornell and then you went to Austin and and all that learning. I wonder, and it sounds like you've had this along the way, different than previous generations. What would you say are some of the innovative methods you're using now in your farm practice?
Yeah, I hesitate to use the word innovative because I feel like that seems too strong. I definitely don't
Still
want to
putting
like,
seeds in the dirt, yes.
I'm still young. Like I'm a in the grand scheme of things, I'm a newer farmer. The state would classify me as a new farmer. I mean, the average age of a farmer is like 65, which is like or 60. It's in the 60s, which is like insane.
Yeah, it is insane.
It's so crazy, but yeah, I hesitate to say innovative because lots of people are doing lots of things, and I don't want people to think I'm like on the cutting edge of agricultural
Okay, fair enough.
technology. But still, I'm happy to talk about some things that I think are important, especially when it comes to like the newer generation of farmers. And for me, a lot of that is revolves around cover cropping. That's a lot of what I did in college, and even after, but.
What does cover cropping mean, if others, those who might not know it?
So cover cropping is generally a crop. So you're going to take a piece of land and you're going to take it out of production and you're going to plant a crop that doesn't necessarily have like economic value. I mean, it does in some way, but not you're not going to be selling it. So the idea is you're growing it and then you're going to terminate it and then basically reincorporate that back into the soil. We talk a lot about organic matter in farming. You might hear about that more and more. But it's a really, really important thing when it comes to soil. It's kind of like if soil had like a currency, it would be like organic matter. And so I think as farmers, we're always trying to think of how we can be adding more organic matter into soil. It's very hard to do that during regular cropping cycles. So like if I'm producing sweet corn or if I'm producing a crop of watermelons, I'm not really adding anything to the soil because I'm taking off what I produced. So we're really more focused on producing what we're going to be reincorporating into soil. And to not get too deep into it, organic matter is it basically it has a lot of functions. It feeds the soil microbiome or microbiology, I mean. And that's always a way to, create healthy soil, helps with water infiltration, so you're not having necessarily all this standing water or flooding. I mean, flooding you can only prevent so much, but helps with drainage, that type of thing. And in general, helps build our topsoil, which, if you read into topsoil as well, we're losing a lot of our topsoil from a lot of ag management. And that's because we do a lot of tillage and things like that that reduce the topsoil. And so part of that is like, yeah, it's a little bit of balance. We have to figure out, how we can prepare our soils so that we can plant into them, but also make sure that we can sustain our soils so that we still have them, in the future. Because ultimately we're stewards of the land. So we want to make sure that, we can produce on them and also future generations can produce on them. Because there's more threats than just, selling off to a developer, and it get developed. We need to make sure it stays, productive land. So yeah, you'll hear a lot of people talking about cover crops. Yeah, as kind of like the sustainable management.
I've also heard a lot about regenerative farming of late.
Yes.
What is that? What is your thoughts on that?
Yes. Oh my God, I love this question.
Okay.
Yeah, this might be a hot take. I don't know. We'll find out. I really don't like the term regenerative ag.
Interesting.
I like the concept. So for people who don't know, regenerative ag is basically the idea of we're taking a piece of land and we're gonna turn it into, a field for production. But the idea is you're leaving it better than you found it. So say you take a forest, you clear cut it and whatever, put it into production, and theoretically you're putting more ecosystem services or whatever into it than was already there. That I think is like, I don't know. It's a tough thing for me to juggle because inherently agriculture is a disruption in the environment. And I think we have to acknowledge that and have to come to terms with that to figure out how we can do it better. It's hard for me to justify saying that we're adding more to the environment by farming. But I think the bigger thing when it comes to this that I have a hard time with is the use of it as a marketing term. It's not a regulated term. And so like organic is a regulated term. I can't use the word organic when it comes to my farming practices because I'm not certified organic. Now
that takes like years to, if you wanted to do that, it takes years of you testing soil and having it, sending it to the state and getting it or the USDA or whoever does that testing.
It's a big process. It's a big process. It costs money and it takes a lot of documentation. It's a lot of work to be certified organic for sure. And I'm not necessarily wanting to regulate everything, but I would be really wary of when people are using the word regenerative because there is nothing behind it. So I'm hearing this more and more and I'm just like, well, what are you doing? Like, they'll be like, well, we're cover cropping. I'm like, I'm cover cropping too. But like, I would not necessarily call it regenerative. Like, I think we can all work towards a better practice, but I think we need to be careful, especially when it comes to consumers. Because for me, I think we have a really valuable position as local farms because we can speak directly to our consumers readily. Like, and we have an ability to be very transparent, which I love. Like, that's why people come to farms. So they know, they're like, how is this food produced? And you're like, well, this is exactly what I did. And then they can make a decision on what they want to do. Like, that's an incredible thing that you cannot get at a grocery store. Yeah. Like, and I am so like sensitive to that. Like, I don't want to disrupt that trust. So for me, it's like when you're throwing out random terms and there's nothing behind it, I don't want to say misleading because that implies like bad intent, but like in some way it is because we don't really have much, there's not much behind it. We have to make sure that there's kind of a standard protocol for what regenerative is before we're just telling customers that we're regenerative. So anyways, yeah, for me, it's like an interesting subject to talk about because it's a newer term. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah, good. Yeah, no, we've just heard it in the recent years and it's like, what is this, you know, what does it mean to regenerate, you know, in terms of farms? And it's like, well, are we regenerating soil? Are we, you know, it's regenerating, you know, it kind of points to this regeneration or care of the main thing of the farm, you know, farm, which is either the soil or the seed, you know, in that sense. Yeah. And yet, as you say, it's pretty vague.
Yeah. Well, and I do want to say like there are principles of regenerative that make a lot of sense to me, like incorporating animals into your systems and trying to create that cycle. I think that's what people are really looking for is that, you know, the cycle of fertility, the cycle of nutrients, these type of things, like the principles of regenerative make sense to me. I think we just have to be careful when we're deploying the term, when there is no, there's nothing standardized about it. There's no regulation behind it. So no one really knows why you're regenerative.
Yeah.
So I don't want to bash on regenerative. I just want to make
sure. No, it's okay.
You're
making your claim. Yeah. It's not, yeah. You know, okay. You're being like two on the controversial scale here. So, all right. So, you didn't think that you were becoming, that you would become a farmer. But now that you are one, I wonder if you kind of look out and over the cross of, you know, a span of a lifetime or the rest of the century and kind of say, you know, what do you see farming becoming? You mentioned that there are a lot of aging farmers and a lot of there's obviously we've all kind of heard of the big ag being involved in farming. So I wonder what your take is of the future as you here you are kind of starting out in the first few years, you know, starting out five, almost probably 10 years of farming. And then, you know, your work worked at Maple Bank in high school. So you've been involved in farming for a bit of a time. And so where do you see it, you know, going over the rest of the century?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. I think it's tough. I mean, along with like when we look at the future of the world, it's kind of hard to see. You know, people are talking a lot about AI right now, and it's hard to know what the role of AI will entail in general. I think on one side, people are talking about how it's going to re revolutionize everything. And as a small farm, I don't know. You know, that technology is pretty expensive. And small farms don't have a lot of capital. So, you know, I think we might see a bigger shift on the larger scale agricultural side, because they are able to get, you know, they are able to have more available capital, and it makes more sense when they're at economies of scale. But it's really hard to say, you know, like over the century, I mean, it could look dramatically different. Even over the next 15 years, I'm not even sure. I'm like, what is going to happen? And I think mainly it's on the technology front, but also the social front. Like, it's, you know, we have a lot of support right now. A lot of community support. People really value local farms and the food we produce for the most part. And like, that's what keeps us going. Like, I mean, financially also, like, just motivation wise. But it's hard to know, you know, like if priorities change in society or whatever, you know, if we don't have that same support going forward, it's hard to know how well the farm will do. But in general, one thing farms know how to do, and for sure the Mabel Bank is a great example of this, farms know how to adapt pretty well to a market. If you look at, you know, the history of us, we've had a lot of different iterations of what the farm looked like. Then there's other farms too. You know, you could look at March Farms in Bethlehem. Like, they've had a lot of different things they've done as well. Now it just depends on how much of a dramatic shift there will be. But for small farms, I don't imagine it changing too much. As long as, the customer and community support is still there, I still see us kind of doing similar things, maybe with just a little bit more technology, but nothing too crazy.
So I think you've touched on this throughout our conversation in ways, and some of it you may not have kind of been consciously aware of doing it when you did, but I think you've shown a lot of courage in, you know, in coming back to a small town, to coming back to an area which you were known, but not necessarily people knew you, to take on a pretty big operation, and the risks involved in that with having a generational owner still around. So I wonder, you know, how you would define courage, and where do you see it in farming today?
Yeah, I mean, to me, courage is just like the ability to continue forward amongst, you know, the challenge and struggle. And I think that obviously that can vary for a lot of people depending on their kind of their context. Yeah, I know people talk a lot about farmers and they're like, God, you're just so crazy. You do all this work. It's like, but it's like so for real. Like, I don't think people have realized, like, this completely takes over your whole entire life. Like, my whole life is this. Like, this is like, yeah, this is my day off. It's not really. It's just the day I don't have staff. Like, I'm doing payroll. I'm paying bills. I still will go in the field and I will still be doing work. Like, and yeah, you have to continue forward without, like, sometimes sacrificing your whole life, like,
It sounds like that. I
for this.
mean, you know, this is, in a sense, one could say it's all consuming, but it's you know, in a sense, what you're saying is that this courage requires, or is asking you to be dedicated to a task and to a process that has certain risks to it, and certainly kind of environmental. What I mean, weather and the changes that can go on at any time. There's also the physical challenges. I mean, I don't think you're an operation that uses a lot of heavy equipment, but certainly some. And there's danger in that. There's risks to being injured and hurt and that kind of thing. But you've also mentioned that it's kind of isolating or lonely or that kind of, I mean, you're being fed off of the production. Your meaning is coming from your work and the result of your work. But there are some trade-offs with that. And I think that is, in a sense, courageous, because you're giving yourself over to something that is asking a lot from you.
For sure. Yeah. And that's definitely been a process over the last, I would say, 3 years, figuring out, like, coming to terms with, like, what I have done. Not like that sounds bad, but, like, basically with the transition, it's I mean, you look at someone my age and what they're doing right now, at least, like, my friends, like, they're off in cities and working a 9-to-5 and have social lives and go to coffee shops with their friends. And I don't really have that. And so that was something, I just had to come to terms with and also figure out my priorities in terms of what really is something I want to be doing. I mean, like, the reality is, like, I've definitely thought about leaving before. Because it's just like, well, the other thing too, I should say, is I'm a single farmer. Like, a lot of people get into farming as a couple.
Yeah.
And, like, I understand why. Like, it makes a lot of sense. But it has just completely taken over my whole entire life. And on the flip side is when I look at myself and I'm like, okay, I feel like maybe I should leave. I literally can't. Like, I'm so invested in the farm. And I don't mean that financially. Like, I want to see the next watermelon harvest. I want to plant the next strawberries. Like, I can't not do it, you know? And so for me, it's re-looking at this in a different way and figuring out, okay, this is how, this part is locked in. You're going to be a farmer. How are you going to rebalance your life?
Yeah, sure.
And figure out the other parts of you. And so, yeah, I guess that is partly courageous to figure all that out. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting life.
Yeah. I mean, because you're taking the time to be reflective on what you're doing. And I think that, and understanding, that part of you that if you weren't doing this, there would be an emptiness to that, though you're balancing out, filling in other parts of your life that also need to be filled, and those trade-offs and how to make that work. I think it is courageous, and I don't mean, when I talk about courage, and I think of, courage as I've said, courage sometimes is just getting out of bed, that to just facing the day can be courageous and can be the biggest accomplishment that one has in a day to go into that day. And so I don't, there is a moral component to courage that means, when we think of the people that are given, like, the Medal of Honor in war. I mean, those people are doing what is considered to be courageous things, often, out of a willingness to sacrifice themselves to help other people, and that's often, what we do. It somebody makes that kind of heroic action and we all pause. But courage just isn't just that moral aspect. I think as I'm talking to more and more people, I see courage as being much more broad and much more endemic, or just a deeper part of the human experience, as broadly. So here it is. I mean, so we've kind of hit these challenges here with courage, but so to turn the other kind of turn the page on this, what do you think that would thriving look like? I mean, if you visioned out and said, hey, this is how this is kind of how I would check off most of or all the boxes in my life. You know, how does that look like? I think you've talked a little bit about it. But let's see if we can kind of land solidly on it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny to think about this question, but I think thriving to me would be like a sense of normalcy. If I could get to a point where I feel like I'm living like a normal life, I think I'd be like, wow, I really have this under control. Like I have worked efficiently enough. I have managed effectively enough to where the farm can run its, not run itself, but like run itself enough to where like I am not there all the time, where it's not so consuming, you know, where I can like take a week night and go do something or like meet up with friends or go to an event without having to like move, not mountains, but like, you know, move people's schedules around and figure out who's going to close the stand and all these things, you know? Yeah. If I could, and I think it goes back to the balance, like balance of life. But if I could get to that point, oh my God, I feel like I have hacked the system. It would be incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, fabulous. Well, I want to thank you for your time. This has been a really fascinating conversation for me, and I think enlightening in many different ways. So again, I appreciate you taking time, you know, right before the harvest season and right in the harvest season, probably. Folks will be listening to this in September, and I think they'll have a grand appreciation of getting out to their local farms and you know, talking with the farmers there and you know, better appreciation of what happens and more curiosity about how they do things. So I really do, really do appreciate, Kirby, your time.
No. Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We appreciate you very much, Kirby. How brave and courageous to share all of that with us. Really powerful and important. The future of agriculture, small farms, small business, the environment, just really touching on all the important things. So friends, the next time you are in Roxbury, Connecticut, please visit Maple Bank Farm, 57 Church Street, Route 317, and learn more about Kirby and his work at maplebankfarmct.com. Thank you for being part of our Salt of the Earth episode on Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan's Courage 2, that's the number 2, thrive.com show. And thank you, Bob, for your wisdom and insight in what it means to be courageous, resilient, and powerful, and what it means to thrive. So I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, founder of Incandescent PR and proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent.tv. We invite you to follow Bob at www.courage2thrive.com and on YouTube at courage2thrive.tv. We will see you next month. Stay courageous and be incandescent. Thank you all.